we're recording, so we'll sing happy birthday
after. Yeah, thank you. Okay. As Ari mentioned, we will be discussing in the next few days three Jewish holidays and aspects of those holidays that are not commonly discussed. And in good, well, I don't want to say Jewish fashion, we're going backwards, right? We're starting with Passover. We're going to work our way tomorrow to Purim, and then the next day back to Hanukkah, right? I don't know why we chose that, but that's the way it worked out. What I want to do today is something, I've got to tell you, in a sense, it is cutting edge. This is something that has been recently discussed and put forward by a number of scholars. It has aroused quite a bit of debate, sometimes even heated, because it suggests that some of the most hallowed Jewish traditions that we know as Jews were not created intrinsically from within the, what shall I say, the treasure of Jewish thought, but in fact were created as a response to some outside phenomena. We like to think of something like the Passover Seder, the Haggadah, as being almost the epitome of Jewish education, a new way of celebrating a holiday by gathering around, discussing the past, discussing how we came to be here today. And it really, it's a very, I think the Seder arguably might be the most impressive night and the most impressive ceremony in the Jewish calendar. And lo and behold, one of my colleagues at the Hebrew University, his name is Yisrael Yuval, and I won't hide the fact that he is the one that has been propounding this theory that I will show you today. He was also a student of mine. Quite a few years ago, I take pride. He came out a very, very fascinating. Let's put things in perspective. You all know there's something called the Haggadah. We all know the Passover Haggadah. How far back does it go? Does anybody know when the earliest Haggadah existed?
It's mentioned in Psachim.
Oh, no, let's be precise. The rabbis of the Mishnah and Talmud talk about various things that are done on the evening of Passover and on the day of Passover. My question was somewhat different. The Haggadah, as a book, as a text, as something that we recite that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the fact is, the earliest Haggadot that we have are only from around the 9th century and 10th century of the Common Era. They appear in the context of liturgical works that were produced by the heads of the academies in Babylonia. They are referred to as the Geonim. So, for instance, we have a Sidur that was produced by one of the famous Geonim, and I'm sure many of you have heard of him, Saadia, who was really one of the great thinkers in Jewish history. He's a great philosopher. And in his Sidur, there is one of the earliest versions, and maybe the earliest version that we have, of a Haggadah. There, we might have a version of a Haggadah 100 years before Saadia, so that'll bring us back into the 9th century, but we don't really have anything earlier than that. Now, I have to qualify that statement. The fact that the Haggadah as we have it today is a relatively late literary work does not mean that the materials that are included in the Haggadah do not have a much, much earlier date for their evolution. In other words, the Haggadah contains many, many different levels of literature. Some of them clearly go back to the earliest stages of the rabbinic period, meaning they go back to the first and second centuries of the Common Era. Others back to periods of the later Talmudic period, the fifth century, and so on. Having said that, however, I've got to qualify even that statement. And that is, rabbinic tradition, almost by definition, we know this to be the fact, was an oral tradition. So even if I encounter a text for the first time, let's say in the Mishnah, late 2nd, early 3rd century, who's to say that that text did not exist in the 1st century BCE, but in an oral context, and it only was put into a book in the 2nd and 3rd century, and that text was then taken the Mishnah and insert it into the Haggadah at a later stage. So you see what we have here. We have a problem in distinguishing between what? The book as a book and the traditions and how far they can go back. Right. Yisrael Yuval came and said something which, as I say, was very, at the time, it still is very provocative to many people. He says, if I find a statement, let's say in the Haggadah, the earliest of which period is 8th or 9th or 10th century. I'll give you a very famous example in a second. And I find a Christian text of the 2nd century that seems to be saying something, well, if not quite similar, seems to be saying something that may have provoked the statement that I find in the Haggadah, why should I naturally assume that it was the rabbinic statement that orally preceded the Christian statement? Maybe the sequence was just the opposite. Maybe the Christians had, for reasons that we will see today in a minute, developed a certain type of liturgical context connected to Passover at the earliest stages of Christianity. And the rabbis came along to challenge their approach, to assert the Jewish position by setting up an alternative description of what Passover is, quote, really about. And the rabbinic presentation is what ultimately came to be the Haggadah. In other words, what Yuval is claiming is our Haggadah, whereas it might contain very early sources, but when we look at it as a text, and even when we look at the sources in the text, might have in fact been the rabbinic response to Christianity. Now, I have to make that clear now. Why would Yuval say this? Passover had a major role to play in both religions when they became distinct, in Judaism and in Christianity. In fact, the most important events of nascent Christianity, of early Christianity, are linked to the Passover. You know, we tend to think that Christmas is the great holiday of the Christian calendar. That's not the case. It is Easter, because the events that took place surrounding a particular Passover of the first century, those events ultimately became the underpinning of Christian theology. Needless to say, in Jewish tradition, the Passover commemorates the removal of Israel from bondage, from Egypt. Maybe not just the formative, but maybe the definitive event in early Jewish history. This is what made you a nation. You are your removal from slavery, you're being rendered an independent people. Now the question is, when Christianity focused on the Passover celebration as the essence of their religion. And of course, you know that the Passover, or rather the Easter Passover, the Christian understanding of the events focuses on two different things. What happened on that Passover of the first century? Well, the first stage is Jesus was crucified, the Passion. What happened? He was crucified. What happened, again, according to Christian tradition, a number of days later? He was resurrected. Basically what today we recognize as being the essence of the holiday of Easter. However, in antiquity, in the first and second centuries, there was a major debate within Christian ranks. What is the more important of those two events? What is the event that should be commemorated as a holiday? Should it be the Passion, as it were, the crucifixion, or should it be the resurrection? And the debate was raging throughout early Christianity. Now, first of all, the distinction is one of dates. When did the first event happen and when did the second event happen? The first event happened literally on Passover. It happened on the 15th of the month of Nisan. Yes, please?
Isn't there a debate on that date?
Oh, we'll get to it in a second. I'm going to get to that in a second. It happened on the first day of Passover. In other words, if you are going to celebrate the crucifixion, you are basically choosing the exact same day that Jews would celebrate as Pesach, as Passover. whether you celebrated the day of the crucifixion, which would have been the 15th Nisan, or you celebrated the evening before, the day before, when Jesus sat with his disciples, in which case you celebrate the day of the sacrifice, the 14th, because as you know, the Passover sacrifice in antiquity took place when? Didn't it took place, actually the day took place before the 15th. It took place on the 14th, and then you sat down that night and ate the meat of the sacrifice on the eve of the 15th, which is the first day of Passover. There were Christians who celebrated the 14th, and they are called the Quartodecimans, and that's probably what you were alluding to. These were the celebrators of the 14th. The Eastern Christian Church, celebrated predominantly in the first generations the 14th and 15th, meaning Pesach, Passover. It was in the West, and ultimately later on in the East, that there was a movement to remove it from Passover to 2 days later and to the resurrection. Why? Why do you think that would be so important to the early church? To separate, exactly. To stress we are no longer part of the Jewish community that celebrates Passover as Passover. Let's use a metaphor, a very famous Christian metaphor. The biblical Passover has been superseded by another event that happened to have taken place on that same weekend, as it were. So the story now of Passover would no longer be what? The story of the Exodus from Egypt. The story of Passover would now be what? The sacrifice of the new sacrifice of a new lamb, and the new lamb, of course, would be Jesus, and then a few days later, his return to life. In other words, just as Christianity uses the image of supersession, one Israel has taken a new Israel, a spiritual Israel, a true Israel, in Latin, veros Israel, has taken the place of the old Israel. You could say, by means of an analogy, and a new Passover has taken the place of the old Passover. We have a new story to tell on the 14th or 15th of the month of Nisan. The Western Church was very unhappy with that because it still stressed the common bond, Judaism. And as you know, one of the big issues was, well, if you're going as a Christian to celebrate your Easter on the day of Passover, who will tell you when to celebrate? The Jews, right? To wait until some Jewish community of rabbis got together and decided, well, this will be a leap year, it won't be a leap year, and when is Rosh Chodesh, and when isn't Rosh Chodesh? And this was a ridiculous situation. And it was only in the 4th century, in the Council of Nicaea, where all of the cardinals got together and decided, we must come and declare a new date for Easter that has nothing to do with Passover per se, and it's only in the year 325 that the church decided that Easter would always fall on the first Sunday after a full moon in the spring equinox. Those are the three factors. Sunday, the first Sunday after a full moon, and once you've said that, you've said it all. Because if it's a Sunday after the full moon, it will never fall on Pesach, because Pesach is always on the day of a full moon. So you see that whoever was formulating that equation, the first Sunday after the full moon, wanted to make a point that the two are no longer, right, connected as such. We have our own reckoning, and it has to be after the spring equinox. Okay. So whereas the Western Church would stress Easter and the resurrection, the salvation, as it were, the Eastern Church, and that is the church meaning where? In the land of Israel, in Syria, in Turkey, in the area of the Middle East, still celebrated at the same time that Jews celebrated Pesach, the exact same date, but they had a different story. Look at the sources in front of you. Look at the first line. The first source taken from a book that was written in the second century, around in the just after the middle of the second century. It is a book called the Epistle of the Apostles, and it purports to describe, in this particular letter, Jesus coming to a group of his disciples who are sitting around doing what? Apparently celebrating. Well, I don't want to call it the Seder, right? But they are celebrating, or the Passover of sorts, or the Easter of sorts. And what does he tell them? Therefore celebrate. What should you be celebrating now? Not Mitzrayim, not Egypt, not the Exodus. Celebrate the remembrance of my death, which is the Passover. In other words, Passover in the early church of the East will now be projected as what? A celebration of the death of Jesus, my death. And when you complete my agape, now this is interesting, agape is love, the word is love, but it's really a sitting down together and eating and talking, as it were, right? When you complete the session and the remembrance of my death, when do you remember it? You shall sit together and talk about my death until when? The crowing of the cock. Very good. All right, he's already headed in the right direction here. In other words, I want you to sit around all night on this new Passover and talk about what? My death. And of course, when he stresses my death, he's stressing and not something else. Now, this is very interesting. There was a discussion among scholars. When did our understanding of the Seder really begin? Is there any evidence that before the destruction of the Second Temple, people would sit around and talk about Yitziat Mitzrayim, about the Exodus from Egypt? No, there is no evidence whatsoever. The only information we have about what was done when the temple stood was two things. On the night of Passover, they ate the Passover sacrifice that had been sacrificed, and they said psalms, they said hallel. They said, right, prayers of thanks to God. That's all we know about from the Second Temple period. So this now is very interesting. Whereas we don't have evidence of a storytelling process on the Passover when the temple still stood. When early Christianity begins, we have, at least in the second century, right, a Christian author telling his flock, we are telling a story. Now you see what my problem is. Is he coming and creating something new, this Christian author of source number one? Or is he saying we're going to be different from our time? Yes, please, you had a question. Very good question. We think that people did actually celebrate something. There seems to be something in Philo. In other words, the more distance you go from Jerusalem, there seems to be some sort of celebration, but other, again, than simply saying thanks, as it were. We don't have any hard evidence of what the ceremony looked like in the Second Temple period. And I can tell you, this is a major issue of debate among scholars to this very day. You know, people love to say, well, the Seder is a Greek symposium. This is very, very common. Everybody loves to bandy that word around. A symposium was a Greek phenomena where they would sit around the table and they would talk words of wisdom to one another. They would take up issues, right? The fact is that the Greek symposium hadn't been around now for quite a while, right? It had really fallen into something of disuse by the time we get to the first and second centuries. So we're not at all sure that the Jews were doing in the Second Temple period. They offered sacrifice, then they got together. There were laws about how you eat the sacrifice, yes. And then they said thank you to God by saying the Psalms. Yes, very quickly. Okay, all right, let's be more precise. There is a story in the Talmud that says that a fellow by the name of Theodos, right, that fellow you're referring to, a Jew, had the Jews of Rome eating kind of roasted meat, as it were, which suspiciously looked as if they were offering up a sacrifice in Rome on the Passover. And the rabbis of Israel sent him a nasty letter saying, boy, Todos, if it were not you, we would have ostracized you a long time ago. By the way, the Palestinian Talmud then adds, what do they mean, if it were not you? And the Talmud says, because he used to have money sent to Israel to the rabbis, right? Wonder if that sounds a little suspicious and familiar, right? But in other words, there were probably Jews who wanted to continue something like a sacrifice by eating meat, roasted meat, that would remind them of the sacrifice. But we're going to get to that in a second. I don't want to get ahead of myself. Yes. No, we don't know. All we know is they're sitting. Now, I assume that Jews were also sitting around on that very same day. What were they doing? They were eating. They were taking.
At that time, at the Last Supper, it was a group of Jews sitting.
Right, and what they seem to be doing is celebrating the Passover one way or another. We don't know how they're doing it, right? We don't know. Because what we know about the Last Supper is when, after Christianity begins to slowly develop, then the sources come along and tell us what they were doing, right? In other words, and contextualizing it within a new religious environment. You know, new, Jewish, but nevertheless new Jewish, right? What would become Christian. But let me show you how we really don't know what... Yes, Nero? Very good. Well, now you've anticipated the next two sources. Okay. Now let me show you what... That's an excellent question. You all know that in the Haggadah we have a group of rabbis sitting around talking about the Exodus, right? Now the question is, when did that begin? Now, and this is where Yuval comes in, it says, show something very interesting. We are all familiar with source number 3. And I'm skipping purposely on 2, you'll see why. The Passover Haggadah says, a story is told of Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Joshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tarfon, who were reclining together at Bnei Brak, telling about the departure from Egypt all night, until their disciples came to them and said, Masters, the time has come to recite the morning Shema. In other words, we have in the Haggadah, for the first time, right, a story that says people got together to tell their Passover story. And what is their Passover story? The Exodus. Now the question is, what came first? Right? The Jewish version of telling the Exodus story or the Christian version of telling the Jesus story? Because who are these rabbis? These rabbis are all post-temple. These rabbis did not live in the Second Temple period. They all lived in the post-temple period. And now you see what the problem is. Right? They are also primarily second century. So whose second century version comes first? Now, why is this fascinating? Because in an alternative rabbinic text, which definitely predates the Haggadah, this is a rabbinic text that goes back also to the second century, and it's called the Tosefta. Look at source number 2. A story is told of Rabban Gamliel and the elders, who were sitting in the house of Boethos ben Zenon in Lydda, and were discussing the laws of Passover all the night until the cock crowed. What were these rabbis doing all night until the cock crowed? The very same phrase that we saw just a minute ago regarding how the Christians described. They were up all night. Were they telling the Exodus story? No. They were sitting up all night doing what? Discussing the laws of Korban, of the sacrifice. In other words, what is the issue? Until the destruction of the Second Temple, they used to offer up a sacrifice. Now that there is no longer a Second Temple, what do? We talk about the laws of the sacrifice. We go through the motions, as it were, of Korban Pesach, of the sacrifice of Passover. Now, what is the question of sources number 2 and 3, which came first? And you realize what Yuval would say. I suspect, he says, that source number 2 is the earlier version, appears hundreds of years earlier in a literary work that we can date to 2nd, 3rd century, whereas the Haggadah we can only date much later. And he would say, I understand very naturally what happened. Jews found themselves without a temple. And so what are they doing? They are sitting around talking about what used to be in the temple. But then, he claims, early Christianity came along and did what? Said, we are suggesting an alternative Passover. It is to tell the story of something that happened in the past. And what is that story? Jesus crucified. And then the rabbis came along and said, no, that's not the real story. What is the real story of Passover? Yitziat Mitzrayim, the Exodus from Egypt. So what he's suggesting is that what you have here is a debate, which is the story to be told on the night of Passover. In other words, sources 1 and source 3, the Epistle of the Apostles and the Passover of Haggadah, are talking to one another, and the big question is, of course, who came first? How do you know? No, but look at source number 2, until the cock crowed. Well, it really means the same thing. It really means, well, by the way, until the cock crowed or until reciting the morning Shema both mean the same thing. We are returning to normalcy. In other words, during the night we were in something of a what? Of a warp, of a time warp. We kind of, you know, we removed ourselves from this world. We were transported, right? We created an artificial shell so that through the night, what will we do? We will recite something is not part of our life anymore. And that could be either a story of the past, it could be a description of offering up a sacrifice in the past, until what happens? Their students come in, or the cock crows, which is basically the same idea. In other words, something from the outside breaches that, you know, that warp, as it were, and says, back to reality, you've got to rejoin this world. Yes. Ah, no. Oh, now, very good question. In other words, what they are saying, right, what she asked was, if the Christians are now replacing a story, and Yuval says that they actually came first in the Haggadah as a response, so what are they replacing? What they're doing is they're saying very simply, we have the Bible. We have chapter 12 of the book of Exodus, right? And what they are saying is, now we're not replacing the Haggadah. What they're saying, according to Yuval, is what? We are telling you that the Bible story of Exodus has now taken on a whole new meaning. What do they mean? Let me explain. The Bible story of Exodus says that what happened prior to the deliverance? There was a sacrifice. What was the sacrifice in the Bible? Say it was an animal. But now what is the new sacrifice that took place? It's Jesus. What did that lead to? It led in the Bible to what? Deliverance. What was the deliverance in the Bible? From Egypt. Now, what is the deliverance? It is the deliverance of the world, of mankind, right? Through his restoration.
So, why did they sit together for just to eat the sacrifice?
They could probably be doing the same thing that the rabbis were doing in the Tosefta. There's no longer a sacrifice in the second century. In other words, remember something. The apostles, in the New Testament, it could be that supposedly they sat around on Passover because there's a sacrifice, right? But source number 1 on your page here, that's not a story that's taking place in the first century. Source number 1, the Christian version, is a story that was written in the second century, claiming it was at that time, at the supper, as it were, or when they gathered on Pesach, that God came to them and said, from this time on, it's no longer the Exodus story of the Bible, right? Nisan, the 14th and 15th of Nisan, is the story of my death. Now, what is interesting is, in that story, it describes, God tells them, you will talk about my death, and I want to tell you something, God says, and I didn't bring the whole text here. He says, as you sit and talk about my death, one of your friends will be released from prison. And he's going to come and he's going to visit you. And it's going to be a miraculous deliverance. And his name, as you will see, is Peter, right? One of the apostles. And that is an allusion to a story that appears in the New Testament. And the story appears in the Acts of the Apostles. I just want to read a couple of lines for you. And just listen, it's not in front of you. On that very night, when they were celebrating the festival of the unleavened bread. This is the 12th chapter of the book of the Acts of the Apostles, right? Peter had been in prison at the time. All at once, an angel of the Lord stood there at the prison, and the cell was ablaze with light. And he tapped Peter on the shoulder and said, "Wake up, quick, get up." And the chains fell away from his wrists. And the angel said, listen to this line, "Do up your belt, put your sandals on, come out." Does that remind you of anything? What does it remind you of? No, more than that. What, when they are leaving Egypt, what happens, right? This is how you shall eat it. Motnechem chagurim, your belts tied on. Na'alechem beraglechem, your sandals on your feet. In other words, what do you have here? You have the story of Peter as if what? He is reliving. What is he reliving? Like an Exodus story. He will be redeemed out of jail. Yuval comes and says, you know what I understand from this? I understand from this a Christian version of what we find in the Haggadah. In every generation, Chayav Adam lirot et atzmo, to see himself as if he were being exiled from Egypt. So he says, you see how the Christians are doing it. They're telling a story happening in the first century, right? And what is the language that they're using, right? The language of the old Exodus story. In other words, the Exodus story now becomes a paradigm. It becomes what? It becomes a paradigm to be reinterpreted, right? So the Christians will say what? It'll be reinterpreted and reassociated with Jesus. Jews will say no, it shall be reinterpreted by every subsequent generation. Because dor vador, everyone has to see himself. That's an equivalent of what we have here. You had a question there. Okay, very good. Now let's get back to the sources, and I want to show you some fascinating things. By the way, the idea in Christianity is what? Our version of Passover supersedes the old version. This is the text. Now look at the continuation of source number 3 from our Haggadah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah said, I am like a man of 70 years. Hare ani kaven shibim shana. Yet I never understood why the story concerning the departure from Egypt should be recited at night. Why must it be recited at night? And then it's recited during the days. And I'm skipping here, since it says, you shall recite the story all the days of thy life, means that this requirement to repeat the Exodus story will be what? Will continue to exist? Afilu limot HaMashiach. Even in the days of the Messiah, we will recite what story, what version? Our version. Kind of sounds a little suspicious, right? Who mentioned the Messiah here? Why mention the Messiah suddenly, right? Even in the days of the Messiah, the old version, right? And so you see what Yuval is suggesting here, right? He knows that there is a messianic group that claims what? That the old Passover story has been superseded by a new Passover story, right? And so what does the rabbi here say? It hasn't been superseded. You must tell the old version of Egypt, even in the days of a Messiah, right? Which clearly means that your Messiah cannot be the Messiah, because what? You claim that everything is wiped out with the coming of that new Messiah. And so suddenly we see that there are very interesting nuances here in the Haggadah. It gets better. Number 4 is one of the most fascinating sources, and Yuval builds a lot of his theory on this source. Christian preacher living in Turkey in the 2nd century, his name, as you can see, is Melitos or Meliton of Sardis. Sardis is a well-known town in Asia Minor, and by the way, I don't know how many of you have ever been to Turkey, but Sardis has one of the most impressive ancient synagogues, right, of antiquity, where there was a large Jewish community there, and there is now a growing Christian community. Meliton visited Palestine, he knew Jews, and he wrote a sermon about Passover. We knew about the sermon until the 19th century, but we never had it. And it only began to be discovered in all sorts of bits and pieces of texts. And it was only really fully put together in the 20th century by scholars, and we have it today. It is a fascinating, albeit quite nasty, anti-Jewish harangue, right? He does not like us, I got to tell you, right? But he talks about the Passover, and some of the things he says are very interesting. For instance, Melitos on the Passover, sections 85 to 88. He attacks the Jews for being ungrateful. He says, look at you people. Look at all the wonderful things God has done for you, and you never recognized it. It is he who rent the Red Sea and led you across and scattered your enemy. It is he who gave you manna from heaven, who gave you water from the rock, who gave you the law at Horeb, who gave you the land of promise. Kind of sound familiar, right? Come, ungrateful Israel, explain to me your ingratitude. Have you valued the 10 plagues? Have you valued the pillar of fire by night and the cloud by day, the passage through the Red Sea? Have you valued the manna from heaven, the water from the rock, the Lord Chore, the promised land? Does it remind you of anything in the Haggadah? Ah, Dayenu, right? And now, again, the same question. Now, we know the exact date of Melitón. He is the second half of the second century. Dayenu appears for the first time in literature in the 9th, 10th century, right? In that Haggadah, that Geonic Haggadah, which came first. So there were scholars who claimed Dayenu is an old Jewish poem that goes back to the Second Temple period. My student Yuval says, look, I only know what my eyes see. I have this from the 2nd century. I have Dayenu, the 9th. Now let's... It's earlier than the 9th. Let's say that the Gonim didn't invent it. But it's going to have to be a big leap of faith, he claims, for you to prove to me that what? That Melitos has the Dayenu song in front of him and he's responding. Why not say just the opposite? Because what is basically Dayenu saying? How we must recognize all of these great things, and they name the exact same things. And of course, that's section 5. How many are the claims of God upon our thankfulness, right? Had he taken us out of Egypt but not executed judgments, we should have been content. Dayenu. Had he torn the sea for us but not brought us out dry? Dayenu. Had he fed us manna? Had he brought us to Mount Sinai? Had he given us the Torah, the exact same things, right? Had he brought us into the land of Israel, we should have been content. Dayenu. How much more redoubled is the claim of God upon our thankfulness, and so on, right? So this Dayenu appears in the 10th, actually I should have been more accurate, it appears for the first time in the 10th century in the Seder of Sa'adia Gaon. Who? Melitón. I don't know. It's a drasha. It appears as part of his sermon, his Passover sermon, and clearly it is very Christian. Well, that's it. Well, that's the argument against Yuval, and it's certainly a potent argument. Whether it can be proven is a question. In other words, where did Melitón get this from? In other words, where did he get this sermon? It's very comfortable for us to say, well, he opened up the Passover Haggadah and he just kind of lifted from it. But you know, you got to prove it, right? And I'm not saying that we're not Torah Shebal Peh, but can I prove this? See, and for a scholar, right, well, but again, I can prove something that it appears in Melitón in the 2nd century and in the Haggadah in the 10th century, right? And you won't be alone in your theory. And many of the scholars that have attacked Yisrael Yuval, and I got to tell you, I don't buy into his theory totally either. I'm kind of with you on a lot of these things, right? But I have to be honest and show you the evidence that he's doing. Yes. Why?
Well, for example, let's go back to the throwing of the cock. Now, the throwing of the cock has a lot of references that bring just early Christian things like the Gospels that have nothing to do with this. For example, I think in the Gospels it says Peter, Jesus tells Peter before the cock is crowed, he's denied.
Right, yeah, oh yeah. Right. I would never build anything on the crowing of the cock. Alone, that's nothing. Yes.
Okay. Then, you know, the one from the Haggadah, there can be a completely independent motivation for the rabbis putting Dayenu in, which is, if you, you know, the Torah, the Jews are consistently ungrateful, for all these things.
Here is question is simply, in terms of the literary structure, who's taking from whom? In other words, what you're saying is, ideologically, you're right. It already is embedded in the Torah. The question is, when for the first time did somebody open up the Torah and decide to write a poem, the Dayanos poem, right, based on what we have in the Torah? And there are two ways of that happening. One could be a Jew opening up, right, the Torah and feeling very uncomfortable and having to write a poem because it renders you uncomfortable. These Israelites got out of Egypt. They should be more thankful, and they're not, right? So that could be one impetus. But the other could just as likely be somebody telling you, remember, these are Christians, some of whom were Jews at one time, saying, you Jews were always ungrateful, right? In other words, I could go and I could put the two together, and I could say it's Christian supersession, as it were, that tells Jews to look back at their text and rethink them and reevaluate them and rewrite the story. In other words, I could say that Dayenu need not necessarily be what? A direct response to Melitoth, but it can be pushed, it can be instigated by a certain tension that there are people out there that say, you Jews were never. But because, again, it looks very similar. But let's go further. His argument, Yuval's argument, is a cumulative argument. Is what he's going to say is no one bit of evidence is totally convincing. But when I start piling them up, he claims, then it becomes more and more, in his eyes, convincing. Yes?
I don't think that the interpretation of the crowing of the crow is correct, because when the Talmud is telling us when to say Shacharit, it's based on a natural observation. Now, we see light, we can differentiate between two types of animals.
Yes.
So there's no reason why you would say.
So you're agreeing with Yuval, actually. Huh? So you're agreeing with Yuval.
I'm saying that the crowing of the crow and the Hebrew interpretation is actually a synonym.
Yes.
Rather than.
But the only question is you have these images in the literature of they're up all night doing something until something interferes.
And the definition is how to define
time. Go to page 2, please. Ari has this little, imaginary stop, right? I got to go further. We got a lot to do here. Yeah.
You had posed a question much earlier about why perhaps the emphasis on Gadah as opposed to sacrifice.
Yes.
Much of it must have been because of the constant association with Jesus and sacrifice. And there was
That's the next source.
Oh.
Okay, there's a source in the Haggadah we all know. Halachma. Anya, this is the bread of affliction which our fathers ate in the land of Egypt. All who are hungry, let them come and eat. Ha lachma, this is the bread of affliction. Where does that phrase come from? And it's in Aramaic, right? Look at source number 7. And he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them. This is my body which is given to you. And you know that that's very, I hope you realize this. What do we eat on Pesach at the Seder? We have bread. We have wine. Bread and I hope you know where bread and wine function, right? Other than in the Leil HaSeder, right? They have a very major role to play in somebody else's religion, right? And then there's a third element. There's the sacrifice. The Pesach, right? And there's Maror. In John 6:50, the exact same words. Ha lachma, this is the bread which comes down from heaven. I am the living bread. In other words, these languages here, these phrases, this is the bread. This is the bread. Remember when they're being said, they're both being said on Passover. They're both using the same phraseology. You can't help but hear. Right, a resonance, right? People are using these phrases. But look even further. In source number 8, Jesus becomes the new Korban Pesach. Jesus becomes the new Paschal Lamb. he's referred to in their sources, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin. In Matthew, now as they were eating, Jesus took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to the disciples and said, take, eat, this is my body. Melitos talks about the herbs. Bitter for you, therefore, is the feast of unleavened bread, he talks to the Jews. As it is written, you shall eat unleavened bread with bitter herbs. Bitter for you the nails you sharpened. Bitter the tongue you provoked. Bitter for you Judas whom you hired. Herod whom you obeyed. In other words, what is bitter? What is the maror of Passover? All these horrible things that you did. Now, look at source number 11 from our Haggadah. Rabban Gamliel would say, whoever does not say these three things on Passover does not fulfill his duty. Pesach, matzah, maror, Passover, matzah, bitter herbs. And now comes something very interesting. And now I will tell you why these three things. Now, this is very strange. This is very uncommon. Why? Isn't it obvious? Why Pesach, Metzah, and Maror are there? I mean, that's the essence of Pesach. But the Haggadah doesn't take that for granted. What does it say? I'll tell you what they really signify. Passover, which our forefathers ate when the temple stood, right? Because God passed over the houses. Matzah, why? Because there was not time for the dough in Egypt, the story of the old Passover again, right? Bitter herbs, for what reason? Because the Egyptians embittered the lives of our fathers. What do you have here? You have a dialogue. What does Passover, matzah, and maror mean? And you have one side telling you, these are the three things it stands for. And you have another side telling you, these are the three things that it stands for. Now, what do you hear in the language of Gamliel? Anyone who doesn't say this has not fulfilled the commandment. What do you hear in a statement like that? What does that sound like? If you don't say these things this way, you have not fulfilled the Pesach. He seems to say, Bidiyuk. In other words, he seems to hear in the background there are people out there who are what? Who are not saying it, or they're saying it differently, right? And so I'm telling you, if you don't say it this way, you have not fulfilled the Pesach sacrifice. And I got news for you. The same Rabban Gamliel, who was the one, those of you who studied with me a year and a half ago here, who was the one who wrote a bracha called Birkat HaMinim, right? It's the same Rabban Gamliel who had a prayer inserted to the Amida, into the Shmoneh Esrei, and it's a prayer that is basically against heretics, against sectarians, part of whom were, of course, early Judeo-Christians as well. Not only that, look at source number 12. Remember the four sons. And we talk about the wicked son. And what is the wicked son? The wicked son is the one who removed himself from the group and denies God. And you have to wonder, right, who is this son removing himself from a group and denying God? The phraseology here, right, conjures up images, right? Somebody who was from within, but then removed himself. And then denied God again. So you see what? This is all very suggestive. Nothing here is right proof, but Yuval is playing with us. He's putting all of this together, and he's suggesting something, right? Now, something very interesting. What does the intelligent one say? Ba, 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 ba. And you shall instruct him in the laws of Passover. One does not conclude after the Pesach. Afikom. What is this, Afikom? Suddenly it's a word that's not in Hebrew. It's a Greek word. Suddenly shows up the word afikomen. What does the word mean? No. And it doesn't mean something you steal from the guy to get a present either. It doesn't mean that, and it does not mean dessert. So if we learn one thing, we'll learn that what the word afikomen means, right? It means coming, going, or right. It doesn't really, what you did is you didn't translate. You said spazieren around. That's interesting that Yiddish would have played a role already in right. The description is that after they concluded a meal in the Greco-Roman world, they would go out and go from party to party. They would go around. But that's not the translation of the word. Translations, afikomen, is the coming or the arrival of somebody, or right, the going, as it were. Melito, in his sermon on the Passover, says about Jesus, for coming from heaven to earth for the sake of the sufferers, and look at the word he uses, hutos, this person, afikomenos ex uranon epitengen, that person, Jesus, afikomen, right, he came to save those people. And what does the Mishnah tell us? After the Seder, what don't I want to hear? Ein maftirin achar Pesach. After the Pesach, what don't I want to hear? Afikoman, right? I don't want to hear this, right? There's going to be no such reference to Afikoman after this, right? And he says, look, the same word appears here. It is he led away as a lamb and sacrificed, and so on and so on. Maybe, and we're going to have to finish soon. One of the most interesting proofs that he brings is something that I discussed with you. I wonder, can I look at these pages here? Yes. There's a page missing here. I scanned the page. A single page? No? Okay, forget about it. I'll discuss it anyway. Look at source number 14. And the Lord brought us forth out of Egypt. Not by the hands of an angel, lo al yedei malach, not by the hands of a seraph, not by the hands of a messenger. This is a major theme in the Haggadah. You know who's missing in the Haggadah? Moses. Moses doesn't appear. Maybe one time, vayaminu b'Hashem Moshe avdo, appears. If you say that pasuk, then you wind up with Moses. But that's really kind of getting him in through the door. He doesn't do anything in the Haggadah, right? Doesn't do anything. Everything is done by God. There are no intermediaries. Not even angels. What is this stress? Not by this, not by that, not by direct relationship between what?
God and people.
Okay. Why?
Lots of intermediaries.
Because what was the classic attack of Christianity on Judaism? Everything you got through intermediaries. When God gave you the Torah, how did he give it to you? Through Moses, not directly. Who received the divinity without an intermediary? The church. And what is the whole idea of Jesus? To have immediate contact with God. And I thought I had sent this page. There is an interesting midrash where they deal with the pasuk in Shir HaShirim, the scripture in Song of Songs, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. Who's kissing whom? Well, the church believed it was a love song between the church and God, and the Jews believed it was between God and the people of Israel.
Is
this
the last page?
It is there? Yes, it's the last page. I didn't know it's there. Oh. Excellent. It is there. Now look what happens. Origen, who is a church father living in Israel in the early 3rd century, writes a homily on let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. And what does he say? You, Jews, received everything through intermediaries until Jesus came to us. And what we received is, and since I have to make a long story short, right? Look at the last line. Who, when he was sent of old to the Bible, said, not by messenger, not by angel, but the Lord himself will save us. In other words, what does Origen say? We received an immediate, right, touch of God, as it were, through his son, etc., etc. And you see, of course, what Yuval is suggesting. What does the Haggadah come to do? The Haggadah comes to counter that argument. You think you were the first ones to receive an immediate deliverance by God? We received an immediate deliverance by God way, way back in Yitziat Mitzrayim, where there were no angels, there's no Moses, everything is lo al yedei shaliach, not a messenger, but by God himself. Again, the same nuance, the same arguments are being bandied around. There's a dialogue going on here, right? And the question, of course, will always be, who instigated the dialogue? Who started and who's responding? Yes.
Sounds like the Haggadah is 700 years later
Oh, well, first of all, you're saying exactly what Yuval is suggesting. In other words, what Yuval is suggesting is Passover now became a very tense period of the calendar, where different groups in the Near East, in the Middle East, were putting forward their understanding of what the relationship between Israel and God is, whether it's ancient Israel or new Israel. Right? The church begins to develop a new image of Passover, and the rabbis are responding to this image by saying that's not the case. It's still the old Yitziat Mitzrayim and not the new Yitziat Mitzrayim, and Pesach Matzan Maror means this, this, and this. So whereas we only have it in the Haggadah, which as a book is edited in the 9th or 10th century, the fact is that these materials go back much, much earlier. The big question is, do they precede Christianity or are they a direct response to Christianity? The truth, yes, the truth is probably somewhere in the middle. There are probably some cases it was a response, other cases where I simply think, and you know what? What you probably have is, in the end, people who still live within one another's communities. In other words, these things were probably developing simultaneously. I think that would be the best way to look at it. Rather than to say who came first, who came second, it's probably traditions that are growing up parallel to one another, and the different groups living in tremendous proximity to one another, literally 100 feet down the street, right, are using the same themes, the same language, the same images, but of course, they are shaping it to fit their own particular thing. All I wanted to do, because I'm getting signals from the dugout here, who's my manager, as it were. All I tried to show you is there seems to be something hovering here in the background of this material. And you know what? Yuval might be wrong. For all I know, he might be wrong. But even if he's wrong, this is only to be expected. These are two communities that are using the same scriptures, the same history, the same imagery. It is only to be expected that each one will say, we have the true and correct version. Needless to say, we in this room know who has the true version, right?
Before you leave, though, I hope that you learned something you didn't know about the holiday of Pesach. Tomorrow's lunch, we're going to explore the holiday of Purim. And then on Thursday, the Hanukkah story, do you think that really happened when there was a miracle of light?
I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to ruin all the holidays for you.
Hold on,
you
realize this. Topic is rethinking Jewish community in America. And there are three subtopics. So please take a look at all the materials. We hope you'll come to more of Dr. Gaffney's presentations. We hope that you will support the CSB. Come to our program. We're trying to get our money in by the end of July or August if possible, because that will tell us what we can do for the following year. Thank you all for coming. And you.
ואני שומע, אני תל אביבית, ושומעת אותך כל כך הרבה מיד. יותר מ-20 שנה.
באמת?
והשנה נסעת באמצע.
כן, נכון.
ודחו אפילו. ואני יודעת שכולם מאוד מחבבים אותה. כולם, הדתיים ולא הדתיים.
זה נורא מצחיק, אתה יכול לברוח מיד בעצמי, גם כשאני מגיע הנה. זה נורא מצחיק.
אתה שומע, אבל מה אני רוצה לשאול? אני גם מתעניינת בארכיאולוגיה ושייכת. ראש הארכיאולוגיה בתל אביב באוניברסיטה אומר ששום דבר לא מצאו.
האדון פינקלשטיין.
מיציאת ירושלים.
אני לא רוצה להתחיל עם זה אפילו.
אז איך אתה מקבל את זה?
זה לא פשוט. אני חושב שהארכיאולוגים חושבים שהם יכולים למצוא כל דבר, ומה שהם לא מצאו סימן שלא היה. זו יהיה איזה מין חוצפה ארכיאולוגית.
בדרך כלל, בכל המצומות, כי איפה, לאן כבר לא נסענו? לירדן, למצרים, ליוון, שלוש פעמים.
המחשבה שדברים נשארו כל כך, היא מחשבה מוטעית, לדעתי. אני חושב. אני לא, זה לא יכול להוכיח שזה כן קרה, אבל זה גם לא יכול להוכיח שזה לא קרה.
תודה רבה.
כן.
זה מזכיר לי את פעם 26,
23,
אנחנו תמיד
משתמשים בלוויה,
ואין תמיד משתמשים.
וכל אחד מבין את זה אחרת. נכון.
אבל זה אותו...
נכון, הכל פרלל. אבל המון, המון, ולכן אני אומר
שהדבר...
כלומר, אבל אם היינו מקריאים את ההגדה של פסח שלנו לקהל נוצרי במאה השנייה, הוא היה מזהה בתיאולוגיה שלו המון דברים, רק שהוא היה מבין את זה אחרת. כלומר, שיש כאן איזה משהו שהוא לא רק פנימי, הוא בהחלט מציץ החוצה, וכאילו יש כאן איזה מין דיאלוג, אף פי שלא ברור מי קרא את זה מבחוץ, אבל יש להניח שקראו את זה.
זה מה שהם אומרים, ההלוג דיינים, זה...
טוב, זה... ברור שהדתות הן דתות קרובות. מה שאני ניסיתי להראות זה בליטורגיה, ב...
אבל אתה לא שכנעת אותי.
לא, אני לא ביקשתי לשכנע.
זה כל כך...
אני לא ביקשתי, אני ביקשתי להראות לכם מה הולך במחקר היום, זה הכל.
זה הכל
דורש
פעם.
כנראה שאלה דומה. יש לנו את התרגום של האפיקומן,
אפיקומן, כן.
שיש לה יוונים,
כן,
לא זוכר את שמו. אנחנו באים כעת לפני הקבוצה שלנו, יהודים, ילדים, האם יש איזה תרגום של המילה הזאת שזה יותר...
לא, לא, זה היסטוריה, זה פשוט היסטוריה, לא. המשמעות הייתה מה שהוא אמר, זה נכון. המשמעות הייתה לצאת אחר כך וללכת ממקום למקום. והרעיון היה שבסוף הסעודה אתה מסיים. אתה לא ממשיך את זה הלאה. אבל הביטוי הוא מעניין מאוד, הוא מופיע בקונטקסט נוצרי. אז לך תדע.
אז יש תרגום ואחר כך יש אינטרפטיישן של התרגום הזה.
בדיוק.
תודה רבה.
Yes.
You know, these I'm familiar with your source, your quotation.
Yes.
Because of the what I call the Maxwell House Haggadah.
Yes.
The traditional, yes, as opposed to actually the ones that we use now and all that.
Well, do.
Yes.
So would it be in Hebrew and Aramaic the same resonating of the phrases which I recognize?
Of course. And that's the whole point.
Yeah, yes.
Right.
So
in other words,
it would stand up that I recognize it in English, but someone in Hebrew and Aramaic
would recognize
it.
Oh, sure.
The same, like,
yes. Yes, definitely. Oh, this, yes, yes, these are.
And you know that this is being eliminated now in the
I know.
Yeah,
well, that's
very interesting, because until you have something like this, it's so boring. Like you say, they stood all night and recited the laws of the sacrifice, whereas the meaning in contemporary is
they,
been expanded. They
want, what does it mean to me? Right, what does it mean to...
Yeah, and but, that's what they condemn.
Right.
That's, you know, the bad son. You know, what does it mean to me? You know?
Right, yeah, right,
yeah.
Right.
So that,
well, that's,
it's a totally different viewpoint.
Right.
The contemporary,
and it sounds as if it's response. Yes.
What does it mean to you?
Well, yeah, but she said no, but to me in the sense that he's removing himself,
yeah,
because it doesn't mean to him, it means only, right. But you're right. And but again, when you read the story of the four sons, it's easy to imagine that they are responses. In other words, why do I present this image of this wicked son the way I present him? It's not something that comes directly out of the Bible. You know, it's out of the Bible itself.
Yeah.
It's something that, you know, you needed somebody to create that kind of foil so that, you know, or that target, so that you could aim at the target and create this wicked son. He's not something that comes out of Exodus. The book of Exodus does not talk about a wicked son, right? So where is this wicked son coming from? So, the suggestion here is there must have been people, when they spoke about a wicked son, they thought about some sort of an image out there that fits the role of a wicked son who's, you know, I have no business with this and so on. Who are we talking about? We're talking about, you know, about an anti-religious Jew in the second century. I mean, well, you know, what are we talking about, right? It has, so that's why he claims what he claims, right? That there's somebody who removes himself from the group and denies God, and that's why he's trying to say it's a response to Christianity. I haven't been totally convinced either. What I wanted to show you is what's happening in scholarship these days. In other words, what are people looking for when they read the Haggadah, right? Don't misunderstand that I'm projecting my own, you know, learning here.
Idea of the contemporary.
Well, talk to Ari. Ari should. Ari can do that.
Because if you don't know the traditional, even in English,
right,
you don't know what.
Well, of course. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. It was very interesting.
Thank you.
It was fascinating.
Thank you.
Did you all get the CSP for next year?
Yeah.
You know, we saw you last year, and Doctor. It's great to see you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
I have a question for you. When did
Matzah? You can. Sorry, I don't want.
I gotta get
yes.
it. Yes.
Plug it.
When did Matzah? Have you actually sent out something with
from as far back as we know?
Telling people to
we have
send
no way of
somewhere.
No.
So
another. I'm gonna email people.
This
no, it's the same. It's the same thing. But I'm gonna email everybody saying.
Here's how to do it.
You're getting it first. Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to redo the cover letter to put it in there. But I had it done already. And I was like, I'm just going to give it out. That's the whole schedule for next year. Attached to the schedule for next year. So.